The Big Journey from Creation to New Creation. This is a Bible teaching series that will take you all the way through the Bible, from the creation account in Genesis to John's vision of the new creation in the book of Revelation. This series is brought to you by creationtonewcreation.com. After their 40 years in the wilderness, Israel was now on the east bank of the River Jordan, poised to conquer the Promised Land. The nation of Israel had been born at the Exodus. Those years in the wilderness that followed were their crucial formative years. They were a time of testing and discipline. During those 40 years, God showed them his love and his holiness. God taught them to obey him. He trained them to rely on his provision and power. That is how Adam and Eve should have lived in the Garden of Eden. That was how God's people were to live in God's new garden, the Promised Land. Crossing the Jordan into the Promised Land was, so to speak, Israel's coming of age. At that point, Israel took on the privileges and responsibilities of adulthood. Until then, God had miraculously provided food and drink for them, just as we do for our own children. And God continued to feed them despite their rebellion, just as we continue to feed our children even when they're disobedient. And our children don't need to earn their meals, they just have to come to the table. Likewise, God's people just had to get out of bed and collect the manna. There was no ploughing, no sowing, no weeding. The manna simply appeared morning by morning. All they had to do was gather it, cook it, and serve it. And Israel's clothes and shoes didn't wear out, just as we make sure our own children are properly clothed. But when they crossed Jordan, God stopped treating them like children. He launched them into adulthood. Now they had responsibility for their own lives. When they began to eat the produce of the land, the manna ceased. From then on, they had to till the ground and cultivate the crops. If they were obedient, God would bless their labours. But if they were disobedient, they would go without, something that never happened in the wilderness, despite their repeated rebellion. The Promised Land, God's new paradise, was situated at the crossroads of the world. It was a bridge between three continents, Africa, Asia, and Europe. And it was at the centre of the world, near the midpoint of the world's land masses. Michael D. Williams comments, "God's choice of Canaan as a land for Abraham was intentional and central to the redemptive mission for which Abraham was chosen. What was important about this particular piece of real estate was its geographic relationship to other lands. It was a doorway to the world, on the way to everywhere else." This promised land was God's strategic bridgehead into occupied territory, into the world that was oppressed by Satan. From the promised land, God planned to extend his kingdom across the entire earth. The rest of the Bible tells us how he would do this. So God's people weren't given the land just to settle down and make themselves comfortable. They were on a mission. They were on God's kingdom business. At that time, the Canaanites lived in the promised land. Their depravity is legendary. They were like festering sores on the landscape. To stop their vile practices contaminating and destroying God's people, there was only one solution: surgical removal. But where there was faith, God showed mercy. Rahab, a prostitute in Jericho, trusted God, and so she and all her family were saved. The very first battle of the conquest was at Jericho. It was more like a series of worship services than a military campaign. The army just did the mopping up. It set the context for the whole conquest. Every subsequent victory, however much fighting was involved, hinged on obeying God. But on the other hand, disobedience brought defeat. Israel's next attack was on the city of Ai. It failed. It failed because of one man's sin. One sin weakened the entire nation. Not until that sin was dealt with could victory come at Ai. The conquest of Jericho and Ai gave Israel a base in the centre of the Promised Land. From here, God's people made two major campaigns, to the south and to the north, respectively. In all, These military operations lasted for perhaps 7 years or so. Then the land enjoyed rest from war, but much land still remained in enemy hands. The tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half a tribe of Manasseh had already been allocated land east of the Jordan. Now Judah, Ephraim, and the other half of the tribe of Manasseh were allotted land too. The tabernacle was set up at Shiloh, nearly 20 miles north of Jerusalem. Then the last 7 tribes were allotted their lands. The main phase of the conquest was over. We read in Joshua chapter 21, "Not one word of all the good promises that the Lord had made to the house of Israel had failed. All came to pass. God is faithful to his people." Before his death, Joshua, like Moses before him, reminded Israel of their history and charged them to be faithful to God. The covenant between God and his people was renewed too. Israel continued to serve God until all the elders who had led the nation under Joshua died. The tribes began to mop up the remaining Canaanites. Then things went wrong. The Promised Land was God's strategic bridgehead into occupied territory, into the world that was oppressed by Satan. But the ancient enemy wasn't giving up without a fight. After a good start, the tribes failed to deal with the Canaanites. They didn't drive them out. That spelt disaster. Then a recurring cycle followed. Israel committed idolatry. Then God gave them into the hands of their enemies, and their enemies oppressed and afflicted them. Then the people cried out to God to save them. Then God gave them a deliverer called a judge, who defeated their enemies and gave them a period of peace. Then the Israelites fell back into idolatry, and the whole dreadful business started all over again. This went on for as many as 300 years or more. The deliverers or judges that God raised up included Gideon and, most famously, Samson. The last judge was Samuel. The end of the book of Judges paints a picture of utter degradation. Judges chapter 19 tells what must be the most sickening story in the entire history of God's people. It involved homosexuality and gang rape. It echoed what happened in Sodom. Adam and Eve were tasked with keeping God's paradise garden holy. Likewise, God's people Israel were tasked with keeping God's new paradise, the Promised Land, holy. But now the Promised Land had become a place of vile depravity. The book of Judges ends with this lament. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Israel was God's new humanity. This new humanity did just what God's first people, Adam and Eve, did: rebel against God and do their own thing. But even in those darkest of times there was light. The little book of Ruth is set in the time of the judges. It ends with a Gentile, Ruth, becoming great-grandmother to a great Israelite king, David, a man after God's own heart. And David was a forerunner of God's great king, Jesus the Messiah. Even during those dark days, God was working his purposes out. Then there's another beacon of light. Samuel was born. He was the last of the judges and the first of a new order of prophets. God, who spoke only rarely in the dark days of the judges, began once more to address his people. Samuel's birth marks a new phase in Israelite history. Samuel was a Levite. He entered service under Eli the priest at the sanctuary in Shiloh. But Eli was weak and his sons corrupt. God's sanctuary had become a place of immorality and greed. Yet worse was to come. The Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant. Nothing like this had ever happened before. God plagued the Philistines, and they sent the ark back. At this moment of national crisis, Samuel led the people in revival. They repented, put away their idols, and bound themselves again in covenant with God at Mizpah. As Samuel offered a burnt offering, God thundered and routed the Philistines. When God is worshipped and obeyed, he gives victory. But Samuel's sons, like Eli's, were wicked. What would happen when Samuel died? So the elders of Israel demanded a king to judge them like all the nations. But God told them that in asking for a king, they had rejected him. Israel wanted a king like all the nations, to judge them and to lead them in battle. But the whole point about Israel was that they were not to be like all the other nations. God was their king. God himself ruled Israel. God himself would go out and give them victory in battle. God gave Israel what they wanted, but before he did so, he warned them what would happen. In Peter Lighthart's words, "Like the kings of the nations, Israel's king will take everything productive from the Israelites, sons for his army and to work on his lands, daughters to serve in his household, fields, servants, and work animals. Israel might as well go back to Egypt, for their king will treat them no differently than Pharaoh. God's people would end up as slaves again, just like they had been in Egypt." So God gave his people a king, King Saul. He was tall and impressive. At first, he ruled Israel well. But soon God had to reject him. Saul's basic problem was this: he was a rebel against God. So God told Samuel to anoint another man to replace Saul. His name was David. Though he fell into sin, David was a man after God's own heart. He loved God passionately and trusted and obeyed him. But Saul's hostility to David drove David into the life of the fugitive. Finally, Saul ended up dead on the battlefield, defeated by the Philistines. David was proclaimed king by Judah at Hebron, and then eventually by all Israel. David was God's warrior king. After his anointing, but long before he became king, David fought a duel with a giant Philistine called Goliath. This duel between David and Goliath takes us back to what we read in Genesis 3. After the fall in the garden, God said to Satan, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." There would be war between Satan and Eve, and between his offspring and hers. But one day a single offspring of Eve would crush Satan's head. That serpent crusher is Jesus. David was a serpent crusher too. Goliath was clad in scale armor. Goliath in his scale armor reminds us of a scaly serpent. And how did David kill him? He, so to speak, bruised his head. David's sling stone sank into Goliath's forehead. After slaying him, David cut off his head. David was a serpent crusher who bruised a serpent's head, and so he foreshadows the final serpent crusher, Jesus. He foreshadows Jesus' final victory over the serpent, Satan. This was just the first of many victories for David. He emerged the victor in a civil war with the house of Saul. David captured Jerusalem and made it his capital. He defeated the Philistines, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Ammonites, the Amalekites, and Aramean forces. God gave victory to David wherever he went. David was the great conqueror king who, together with his mighty men, completed the conquest of the promised land. In Stephen Dempster's words, they finished the job that Joshua had started. David's sphere of influence expanded as far as the Egyptian border in the south to the upper Euphrates in the north. This fulfilled God's promise to Abraham that we read in Genesis 15, verse 18, "To your offspring I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates." David brought the Ark of the Covenant into his new capital, Jerusalem, but he wanted to build a permanent temple for God. So God sent Nathan the prophet to speak to him. What Nathan said to David is a key prophecy in the Bible. Through Nathan, God said that he would make David's name great. Then he made these tremendous promises. Firstly, God promised a secure land for his people, free from oppression by wicked people. Secondly, God promised to build David a house, meaning a royal dynasty. This dynasty would endure forever. Thirdly, David's offspring would build God a house. Prophecies in the Bible are sometimes fulfilled at more than one level. That's the case here. On one level, these promises were fulfilled through David's son Solomon and the line of kings that ruled Judah over the succeeding years. But on another level, it was fulfilled through a greater son of David, Jesus Christ. Firstly, God promised a secure land for his people, free from oppression by wicked people. David conquered all his enemies and bequeathed to Solomon a secure kingdom. That's one way in which this promise was fulfilled, but there's another and greater fulfillment. One day, Jesus the Messiah would deal the death blow to Satan, the arch-enemy of God's people, and in the age to come, God's people will live on the new earth forever. Satan and sin will never touch them again. Secondly, God promised David a royal dynasty. David's dynasty did indeed continue for hundreds of years. But this promise is fulfilled in another, much greater way. The dominion of David's son, Jesus Christ, will never end. Finally, God said that David's son would build him a house. David's son, Solomon, did indeed build God a house. It was a magnificent temple. But this promise is being fulfilled in another, much greater way. Jesus, David's greater son, is now building a temple made up of God's people and indwelt by God himself through his Spirit. That temple is the church. These promises that God made to David were a covenant. We call it the Davidic covenant. The Davidic covenant was another step forward in God's great plan of redemption. God promised Abraham a paradise and a people who would bring blessing to the entire world. Now God is telling us more about how those promises were going to come about. Through these promises that God gave to David, we learn that a king was going to come. And through this king, God would fulfill all his promises to Abraham. From this point onwards in the Bible, we are looking for God's king to come, the son of David. But time and again, when things begin to look really hopeful for God's people in the Old Testament, sin enters. The echo of Nathan's remarkable prophecy hardly died away before David committed adultery with Bathsheba. He arranged for her husband to be slain in battle so he could take her as his wife. David repented, and God forgave him. David was still a man after God's own heart. But David paid a heavy price. From then on, David suffered trouble and strife. The consequences of this sin cast a deep shadow over the rest of his life. But God's promises to David stood secure. His son Solomon succeeded him in around 970 BC. Israel entered a period of peace and prosperity unequalled before or since. After he became king, God invited Solomon to ask him for anything he wanted. But rather than riches or reputation or the death of his enemies, Solomon asked for wisdom. He wanted to rule the nation with God's wisdom. God granted his request, and Solomon became wiser than all other men. Solomon had asked for the right thing, and God was pleased with his request. So God also gave Solomon great wealth and fame. People came from far and wide to hear Solomon's wisdom. The Queen of Sheba came to test him with perplexing questions, and he answered them all. Solomon composed 3,000 proverbs and 1,005 songs. The Song of Solomon, ascribed to King Solomon, explores the deepest and most wonderful mystery of human life, the way of a man with a woman. Solomon was the principal author of a book of Proverbs, and he inspired the book of Ecclesiastes. These two books teach us how to think and live in this fallen world. In the next talk, we'll trace the history of God's people from the days of Solomon to the years preceding the birth of Jesus the Messiah.